I guess. So now we are sort of leaving the regime that we have some understanding of the universe. I just really want to emphasize, if you have interest in further about SMB, especially how to connect the observations with theory, Kendrick is really the leading, world-leading expert. He's like the leading expert in analyzing Planck data. And now he's branching out to other observations, like some areas of telescopes too. And he's going to teach you guys the exploration course. So you will know a lot more about CMB if you want to. Just ask him. And same idea that today we're going to start the topic of dark matter. And we have Mina here. And I just saw Cliff and the other people coming in. I mean, they are the people who are working on it. And there's Maxim. Like, there are lots. Especially on Tuesday. Cliff is coming in today, I don't know. But on Tuesday, there is like a whole particle physicists gathering from the nearby place to PI. It's like a PI particle physics day. It's kind of crazy. And like, if you want to know what the most popular things about dark matter, and the other people to ask. And as to this lecture, we are again learning a history class. So what do we so far know about dark matter? Well, they're dark. And they are counted as matter. They are all non-trivial statements. So dark actually means two things, two different things. It could be something that can emit photons, but they are way too faint. Like if there's a Jupiter-sized thing, they are actually called a Jupiter. They are like also known as, very sadly, the failed stars. And if there are a bunch of them in other galaxies or even like in other solar systems, we're not going to be see them. They are baryon. They are able to emit photons. They're just too faint. And dark, there is another meaning, which is what we have been using in our lecture, is that they just couldn't care less about the photons. They just don't interact with photons. They're just non-baryonic, and at this point, we don't know in any way they interact with standard model particle. Of course, we propose they do. So I just want to first mention how dark matter comes into play. We have already seen. Then we'll go to the historical point of view, like to say up to now, we know nothing about this thing, but what we know say they are not, and what's the proposals. It's really fun. I'm talking about things, in a couple years could change. So remember this omega m, omega lambda plane that now, basically, this is the add up equals to one thing. And you can see the clear plot. I could find a copy to post data, but basically CMB. And something called a bionic acoustic oscillation. Basically, when we see that giant ball of gas is oscillating, and there's actually specific experiments designed to detect those bionic acoustic oscillations. And they tell us, as I try to wave my hands pretty hard, to say that some aspect of their experiment basically tells us our universe is pretty flat. It's not very deviated from flat, i.e. that omega k is constrained down to percent level. And then, as we see in the tutorial, there is another line called accelerating decelerating. And this slope is precisely 1/2. This you have shown in the tutorial. By taking a derivative of the Friedmann equation, you can look at the acceleration which it's that line. It's omega lambda equals 1/2 omega m. If you have more dark energy than that, you will accelerate, otherwise you decelerate. And then, here comes the supernovae. Independent parameter is some other combination of linear combination of omega lambda and omega m. Says that it must fall this value. This is as it's accelerating. They can actually measure how much it's accelerating. And in order, remember that we say that it's basically an inverse square log get modified by the universe metric, and in a specific way. And you can calculate that a specific way. And you can compare with different constitution of the universe. And then we make a conclusion, says that today we're living in somewhere omega is about 0.3, and the dark energy is about 0.7. So it's like 0.32 or 0.68, but anyway, that's basically what the universe is made of today, with trace of radiation, which is all mostly in terms of a CMB. So we have seen that, and that's our, so those experiments give us evidence, though these are much later experiments, says yes, we have a dark matter, we even know how much we have. And the second thing is what we say in structure formation, that if there's only bionic matter, which can only, the fluctuations can only grow after decoupling, then it's not enough. Like you can't form galaxies of our own galaxy size. You can form some dwarf galaxies. And the dark matter fix the problem by starting early. They can start at as early as matter domination transition. Once matter starts dominates, they can start grow. And some thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years later, the bionic finally, the photon decouple, the bionic fluctuation can grow. But at this point, the dark matter already growed a little bit and formed some gravitational well, so then bionic matter can easily catch up. So this is what I've seen in the lecture so far related to dark matter. So basically, we know this thing exists. But historically, it's an interesting, very interesting history. So basically, all the evidence pointing to dark matter. We imagine dark matter, you know, corresponding to some sort of particle. But so far, all the evidence is coming from gravitational interaction. We have failed in all aspects about trying to pin down which particle dark matter is. So of course, there are a group of people think, okay, you know, maybe it's not dark matter. Maybe, you know, somehow gravitational interaction described by Einstein somehow just doesn't work in the cosmological scale. So this people, so a side remark before we start the journey of the historical discussion is that there's something called a MOND. It's like the modified Newtonian thing. Well, one very specific example is, remember your Hilbert error. Einstein action is really simple. It's just a Ricci scalar. But you know, if it's a function of Ricci scalar, you still satisfy all sorts of symmetry. You are still only using Ricci scalar. You just write it as a function of. So that's a candidate for this kind of modified gravity things. But when I was in the graduate school, and Nima, you know, the Nima, Aki Hamid, come to Cornell and says he's going to give a talk on this modified Newtonian theory thing. And so we got very excited. And he was coming to giving like 10 lectures on scattering amplitudes anyway. But you know, when Nima comes, he can just keep talking, and it's full of insights. It's awesome. And then we move to the Astrov building from our building, and then he says, "Oh, the title of my talk is Do Not Modify Gravity." So I really don't know much about this. I think there is a person called John Moffat around the PI. I haven't seen him recently. And he has some other idea about how to modify gravity. But after that talk, basically I was like, okay, never mind. Let's try to find, you know, the dark matter particle instead. Okay, so that's completely a side story. But if you're interested in modifying gravity, that's definitely, you know, a clear research front. If you are managing, the problem about modifying gravity is that the Einstein theory and the Newtonian, especially Newtonian gravity, is tested in like just so well. And if you want to modify, then somehow has to fit all this data accumulated in 300 years, it's just hard. So let's see. So now let's start the history. So it starts really early. There is this Zwicky guy. He is the first person who trying to like indicate that there is something in this universe that is dark. So what he does is what he study is he look at big clusters. And then, of course, they are made of galaxies. And then what he studied is trying to measure the velocity of these galaxies, which, you know, it's our favorite thing to measure. There's Doppler effect, so we can always sort of get it. So that's what he measured. And then he claimed, says, Then he looked at this cluster. There is some stars, and there is some gas between the galaxies, and then of course you can get a mass out of this. And then so he make the conclusion, says there is no way this thing is holding together, because he can calculate the escape velocity of this thing with the mass. According to his calculation, the structure should be falling apart and all, everything should be escaping. So I'll try to do the calculation. It's not a hard calculation. So basically you make the best assumption of such a structure ever is say there's a galaxy and each of them has mass m, and they are just, you know, randomly there. And then says total mass is big N times small n. It's a Newtonian process, and you study the behavior of the system. And then you can easily write down the kinetic energy. Oh, you also assume they all have average speed. So it's a very simple system. And you can write down kinetic energy, you can write down potential energy. So basically all the n and the small m is combined as a big m. Okay, there is a approximate sign. Like if you pair two galaxies up, then you get a big n times big n minus one, but let's just take that to be n squared, then you get this thing. So then it comes to a theorem known as the Virio theorem about a gravitationally bounded system. So for gravitationally bounded system as proposed, that Virio states that the kinetic energy is equal to minus 1/2 u. And if you want to prove that, basically, you write down the moment of inertia. Says, well, the moment of inertia of this thing is probably a constant. And then you take two double derivative of this, and you will get R double derivative, but that's just Newton's second law. And so after about three lines, you'll come to the same conclusion, which is says that the kinetic energy and the potential energy of a gravitational bound system is related by this relationship. So then we can just equate those things. Okay, 1/2 and then 1/2 cancel. So you have mv squared equals g m squared r squared. No r, sorry. And then you can solve for m, which is v squared over r divided by g. So basically, it says that for a gravitational bounded system, the mass is related to speed and the radius in the following way. So speed is, of course, measured by Doppler shift, and that radius is basically measured by luminosity. Like you want an average radius, and then they find where it produces half the luminosity and take that radius. But the point is, this mass, if you calculate it, it's about 10 times larger than the mass that they measured from the start and the gas. So, one more. And so this is off by a factor of 10. And you know, Tsuiki has no choice. He decided to propose there must be some dark matter exists, and he actually calculates. He says that if I use this rule to calculate all the clusters' mass, and you know all the clusters, and then you just calculate the whole mass of the entire universe in clusters, so let's call it omega cluster. Today is given by 0.2 by that calculation. So basically now we have a lower bound. Is that the matter content of the universe should be bigger than 0.2. There should be other things. He didn't count anything like is in the void, for example. Now this is truly incredible. At that time, in 1932, 1 year before he proposed dark matter, we discovered a neutron. So it's a ridiculous like idea that for everybody else, this is ridiculous. What do you mean by dark matter? Well, turns out he's right. And then the next evidence is not until 40 years later by Vera Rubin. Let me check. I think it's 40 years. Yeah, I think it's 40 years. Okay, Vera, she is working on, again, guess what? Studying velocities of things. It's a very popular thing to do. When you measure things in the sky, you look at the spectrum and use Doppler effect to figure out how fast they are moving. So what Vera Rubin is measuring is that for a galaxy, there's something called a rotational curve you might have heard of. And she wants to find the velocity, how velocity depends on the r of the radius of the galaxy, of where you are. So let's say what we expect first. Cool. Okay. It looks more like a bat than a galaxy, but so there are a lot of spiral galaxies, like just like our galaxy. It has spirals, it has disk, and most of the star is in the center. We live in the spiral. But then this probably has some thickness. But otherwise, this part is pretty empty. And then if you take a, I don't know, star, solar system, in this edge. And the first thing we can do is do a Newtonian approximation, says all the mass is at the center, so gm over r square equals to v square over r. And you get a 1 over root r dependence you probably have already seen a lot of times before. So this is what we expect. And by the same formula, you expect something like this. It grows linearly. It's taking the density to be constant, and you calculate what's the speed inside. It's an exercise I don't need to replay, to repeat. So this is what we expect. And how much are we off? Well, this is what they see. It's asymptotic, a constant. And you wonder, how can we get it observe the curve like that? So what the people typically do is they do a much better model than the Newtonian thing, says, well, what they say about the galaxy is that it has a density profile, and for gravitationally collapsed things, normally they have a density profile that it decay with R with a power law. Or maybe in some other way, but the power law is the easiest one to study. So then we do a integral to figure out what's the mass, and then you plug that in again, which says v square should be proportional to m over r, which is r2 minus x, and this tells us v should be proportional to r1 minus x over 2. So simple calculus, Newtonian mechanics gives us that. And then you ask, how can I get a constant? If we need to get a constant, we need a profile of x equals 2 such that the exponent disappears. So the prediction is that the density profile like that. But that's not how the stars and gas in the galaxy behave. They drop off quite steeply, as like in this drawing. Like at some point, they decided to just disappear. So r to the minus 2 is certainly not the density profile for the visible matter. And then the propose is there's dark matter. Basically, the game to play is that the density profile of the luminosity thing is probably they can somehow figure out because they shine light. And then you come up with a dark matter density profile such that they add up. Such that they add up together and produce that observed curve. So then the thing is, of course, see, this is where cosmology still is a experimental physics. Is that after they see this, of course, they see another like 11 galaxies. They're like, okay, look. And then, you know, people will be going after more. Basically, they say, okay, look, all the galaxies seems to be have something wrong with their rotational curve. It's not just one. Like, it's all of them. So basically, the dark matter profile that come into is like a halo. It's like a big giant ball, but not as much in the center. Where that ball is. Feels like a donut, but it's different topology. Okay, so then people really become serious. So 1970s is when people began to really hunt for dark matter. This rotational curve convinced them that the dark matter probably exists. And so people began to try to estimate, of course, if they exist, how much they are. It's a very good question to ask. So let's talk about how to actually measure matter density in universe. So here is a way to measure matter density. First of all, people are happy with their knowledge about luminous stuff. So if you are shining, then it's good. Then they say we basically can measure that to like up to 5%, but it's pretty accurate. You can measure the luminosity density of the universe. And the only thing we need to do is convert the luminosity to mass, of course. And this comes to a tutorial, a small part of your tutorial problem, is that we have done that before, to calculate a mass to luminosity ratio. So the study shows, so basically everything is measured by, this is one. So everything is measured in terms of the sun, because we know the sun very well. And the study shows that if the mass increase, and of course, we will expect the luminosity would increase, but the study of a lot of stars shows that it increase faster than linear. That's just an observational fact. You look at this star, look at this star that is more massive, and look at how luminosity it is, and you calculate the ratio, and that's a fact. And that tells us that this mass over, it's just simply called a mass over light ratio, would be smaller than one for stars that are bigger than mass, bigger than the solar, because the luminosity grows faster. And then this ratio would be bigger than one if you have a smaller star. And if you look at the galaxy, what kind of stars you have more? Actually, it's the smaller star, because the big star burns really fast. So for example, they did this with Milky Way. Milky Way has this mass to luminosity ratio about 2.2 for our own galaxy. And then for other galaxies, it began to be hard, because if you want to study a galaxy's that ratio, then you need something moving around to induce the mass. If you saw something is moving around, then based on Newtonian analysis, you would guess the mass. But we just figured out it's way out there. There's no star that is moving around. So then the galaxy's mass is very hard to measure. So people turn the attention to the clusters, because clusters is made of galaxies, and there's always galaxies moving around. It's much more visible than the star. So then they look at a lot of clusters and they realize, oh, this ratio is much, much higher. So clusters are not as bright. For cluster, this thing is something like 200 to, I don't know, 300 something. So it's not bright. Not that bright, but the point is that if we would know this ratio, and then we know how much luminous things we have, then we know the mass. It's just multiply them together. So they multiply together, divided by critical density, and we wouldn't bother you with numbers, because I saw your reaction about the numbers. So the result is that they figure out that they have a bound, because none of this measurement is particularly accurate. But they put a bound on dark matter, and as you say, well, I think it's like four or something. Four, five, maybe. But the point is, with this estimation, by assuming there is a dark matter halo, and by looking at cluster of galaxies, by marrying this luminosity and the mass ratio, they figure out how much matter it has to be, dark matter, or matter has to be. So these are the two most important. Well, basically that's the first one, and that's the second one, which is the determined one that says everybody become too excited. Okay, let's hunt for dark matter. Well, they are there. All right. So first, let's put it into some categories. As I said at the very beginning, there is actually could be bionic dark matter, and there is the non-bionic dark matter. It's a very good category system. You are either bionic or you're non-bionic. And there may be a combination of both, but for a particular candidate, it falls in one of the categories. And for bionic dark matter, there's also this dark means, you know, it's just we don't have enough. We don't have good enough experiment. It's not intrinsically dark. So for bionic dark matter, we have macho and gas. So macho stands for massive astronomical compact halo objects. So they are the things I mentioned, the dwarfs, you know, star at the end of their life, and Jupiter's, you know, the not so successful stars, but they are faint, we kind of see them, and some people even ask, could it be Pluto size? And then this then we immediately, like, they were like, oh, also there is a very interesting kind of, there's also neutron star, but there's very interesting called the primordial black hole. So if black hole is produced after BBN, then the bionic contact is already taken into account. But if it's produced before then it counts as much bionic dark matter. Okay, so I should say, why would we be interested in this first? Sorry, I'm backtracking a step. So the thing is, when we do our BBN tutorial, I insist to attach that picture at the very last page, like to just show you that picture to show that how successful we are. The BBN basically tell us the baryon to photon ratio, and orthogonally, CMB also can tell us the baryon to photon ratio. Very good, they agree very well, and they agree with our helium abundance and some other abundance and some other abundance. It's awesome, except, you know, astrophysicists tell us we didn't find that many. So after Planck, the superior version of Cobian WMAP can measure everything so much better. And we have a 40%. Discrepancy. There are 40% of missing baryons. It's always there, like after, so like we know the baryon density is this much, but it's just not seen. So we are interested in baryon dark matter. Well, there used to be a discrepancy. It was resolved last year in June.
Discrepancy is between what we observe with the satellites and what we predict theoretically?
No. The discrepancy is between what we induced from Planck satellite and what we can see by astronomer, like just actually look at them. Just like look, point to the telescope, look at the stars, the gas, the dust, whatever. So. And the CMB is, you know, from the last scattering. So they are completely different things, but they should agree. But they don't. They're always missing things. They were missing things. We were missing baryons up to June last year. So, but macho is, you know, small, compact object, star size. Let me once again draw our galaxy as a disk. And then we are somewhere here. And then this is a halo. There might be a macho. And then there might be some other galaxy, nearby galaxy in our local group. What they use is the large, some cloud. Sorry. Some cloud, large. And I didn't write it down. Large metallic. Okay, I'll figure out that the cloud, but it's called, it's a galaxy nearby called some large cloud. And the middle word is apparently too difficult for me to remember. And the point is, there could be a star here. And then this is finally totally about the GR. And I think you probably did a homework on it. Is that if a star emits light, and then there's a macho, but the light gets banned, and it's in here, and it's like a lens. So this is called the gravitational lensing. So the light gets focused, so it becomes brighter. So the good thing about this macho brightness is that it's independent of wavelengths, so it's universally bright, and its time scale is days or up to months, which is nice because that distinguishes this kind of brightness from something called a variant stars. Like there are other ways a star would be suddenly bright for a bit, but this profile is unique, and the people get really excited. But think about it, this is not easy. We require three things to fall in a line. It doesn't happen often, like eclipse doesn't happen that often. But we do have like a whole galaxy of stars. And these things last more than one day, so basically you just check every night. So you take a picture of the whole galaxy, check every night. And then two, suddenly one of them brights, and then you check if it's because of macho or it's because of other reasons. And there's lots of groups, you know, start to look for this. And they found something, but it's just way less than we needed. They are just not big enough. So, and then this is resolved in June 2018, half a year ago. They realize, these are gas, intergalactic gas. They're actually extremely hot. They're like 10 to the 6 Kelvin. And they have like three phases. They have a warm state, which is already really hot. But then there is like hotter phase and then even hotter phase. The Nature article is on the wiki, you can read about it. But the gas, it's somehow, there's a technical issue, like it's really, just somehow is not observed before, and they solved that technical issue. It's kind of experimental for me. I don't know how to explain. I don't really understand. But the point is that they found the gas. They estimate how much gas we have. It's 40% we're missing. So no discrepancy, we're safe. And of course, all our mystery things is about the non-bionic dark matter. So non-bionic matter, we can also make some categories. There's the hot ones, and there's the cold ones. This is referring when they are decoupled. When decoupled, the hot ones is the relativistic ones, and these are the non-relativistic ones. And this category is it's also pretty good. But actually, we're missing something this time. We'll come back to that. So basically what, as you might infer from the fact that our concurrent most successful cosmological model is called a lambda CDM. So it's probably the cold dark matter is preferred. There are some reasons why hot dark matter not preferred, but one is actually what I have already encountered, I just didn't mention it. So during structure formation, the dark matter is crucial. And you can think about what hot dark matter could do to us. What hot dark matter do is that they're relativistic. It's like, remember yesterday were some photons? but that it has a damping effect because they're just zooming around and erasing all the fluctuation. The hot dark matter basically do the same thing. They are relativistic, they're just... So what happens is if we have a hot dark matter, they will just erase the small scale of the fluctuation, but you know they can't travel infinite far. So at some scale, they will still form some structure. So what I predict for our universe structure formation is what is called a top-down model. So basically, because they are erasing all the small scale fluctuation, we should have formed super cluster first, and then they fragment into clusters, and then you know that you get a galaxies. Well, as you see, if you have cold dark matter, they are basically a bunch of particles chilling there. Then the self-gravity will win. They will want to form structure, so it's exactly the opposite way. It's called the bottom up way, which it will start from galaxy to cluster and then to supercluster. And then we're coming back to the age problem again. So who is older? It turns out that, you know, our oldest galaxies is way older than the superclusters. The supercluster is only forming like in the last few billion years, but you know that the oldest star is, you know, 13 billion years ago. So this is what a structure formation picked for us. And hence, most of the dark matter must be cold. If you have too much hot dark matter, you will break that structure, and that's what we have seen. So we're just gonna leave. Actually, you were studying hot dark matter. Well, you will or you were, depends on you finish your homework not yet. Because in the second part is to ask you to make a bound on neutrino mass. It's basically assuming the neutrino is a hot dark matter, and you are making a very cool bound that says if the neutrino is contribution to the hot dark matter, then it shouldn't contribute more than the mass of the whole universe. And that actually gives you a bound on neutrino mass, which is kind of interesting. And of course, the best bound on neutrino mass is from the oscillations. So then we have cold dark matter, which is the topic of our tutorial today. But before that, because this is a longer, we take the detour, say, wait, but hot dark matter, cold dark matter, yes, sometimes people have referred to warm dark matter that, you know, the mass happen to be sort of equal to the temperature when they decouple. But there is actually something else. Because when we do this two category, we assume that they decouple. Decouple means at some point they couple. Yeah? There is a type of things called axion. They are called the Born code. So basically, our argument is if the particle is light, it will have a huge velocity and erase all the structure formation and it was ruled out. But the axion, they could have just Born code. They could be light and have not much velocity because they were never in thermal equilibrium. So the axion is a very interesting topic. I'm sure you're going to say them again, but the most interesting one is the QCD one. You don't need to know QCD. What do you need to do? You need to know is the Young-Mills action that I feel that almost all of you get asked that question in the interview room. So the Young-Mills action is given by G mu nu, and it has some color index to trace. And then we ask lots of questions about this, like, but you have been lied to. There is another term. We could have written another term that respects all the symmetry, and it should be allowed, and there's absolutely no reason why we don't have it. Which basically is using the dual strands And that is our axiom. It's just the couple between them. So it's like f mu nu, except it's the using the epsilon tensor to tensor. So this thing is called the QCD axiom if you're talking about a QCD. And there's no reason that it's not there. The only reason is that we have never seen it. And the observation gave a bound of like 10 to the minus 10, something like that. And people are, of course, wondering why it doesn't exist. It exists, it will make us very happy because this is a CP violation term. As you know, the CP violation is kind of required for the bionic genesis. But anyway, but this is a very good dark matter candidate. At about 200 MeV, when the QCD, the plasma turned into like a baryon, some axion is made. It's made after thermal equilibrium. So it's not going to couple back again. So this thing is born cold, and people have lots of research. You could just randomly go to a seminar. It's this entire seminar is telling you about a search for the axion candidate dark matter. There are so many people because there's no restriction on the mass. So they're in different mass regime, different experiment is sensitive to it. But the result is, of course, that we didn't find anything. So finally, let's talk about cold dark matter. And they also, almost equivalent, have a name called a WIMP. It's the weakly interacting massive particle. And our tutorial this afternoon will be study a very, at least considered by me, a very important calculation, which is mostly known as WIMP miracle. And the idea of WIMP miracle is basically you make very general assumptions, which is the dark matter often somehow denote as a chi. And then there's a chi bar. They meet, and they produce some standard model particle. So this is the interaction you assume the dark matter has. It's just very weak. And they decoupled, then it's just very hard to observe. And if we make this assumption, and we solve some Boltzmann equation. It's not the hardest Boltzmann equation to solve, otherwise I wouldn't put it on the tutorial. And you solve some Boltzmann equation and have some idea about the abundance of the dark matter when they decouple. And we'll just use that delayed, diluted by the volume to estimate how much dark matter we have today. And the WIMP miracle is basically say that assuming this is the process contributing to the dark matter we observe today, this interaction strength is at weak scale, which means it's like 100 GeV. For the mass of the propagator things. So that's the calculation we're going to do this afternoon. So it's really miraculous because why should the interaction strength to be at the weak scale? Nobody knows. But of course that inspired a lot of models building upon. So basically this Feynman diagram can go either way. So this is called the channel that the Fermi lab is looking for. It's basically there are so much dark matter particles in our halo, and occasionally two of them should collide to each other. And if they produce standard model particles, maybe we can see them. So this is one way of trying to detect dark matter. And of course, you have the other way. This is a scattering event. Basically, you just have a huge amount of heavy nuclear things and waiting for a teeny recoil. So if a dark matter, it's the same way that people use to detect neutrino, is to look at what the other thing do, because we kind of see the thing, the other thing. So basically they say there's the dark matter, maybe, you know, it knock into a spinner model particle, and interaction strength is weak, we can't see it, but the standard model thing, particle might has a recoil. And maybe we can see that. And it needs a heavy nuclei, because if you, you know, a bowling ball is very easy to deposit energy to bowling ball. But if you throw a bowling ball to a ping pong ball, then it doesn't recoil that much. So that's why they need a bunch of heavy things, like in terms of an atomic number. And then, of course, there is this production. Says that that's what in the LHC they do. They slam standard model particle things together and hopefully see some missing energy. They could identify as dark matter. So, important Feynman diagram, you can read it in any way you want. And so basically, at this point, if there, apparently, so this is quoting Neil Wiener, that apparently all the dark matter proposals, particle physics proposals, are categorized in three categories, that some are reasonable, some are weird, some are crazy. So reasonable is basically say if it's a standard type of axion, then that's reasonable. And if you're proposing the least, the lightest superparticle, the LSP, because if you have a supersymmetry, then the lightest superparticle can't decay anymore. It should be stable. It's an awesome, awesome dark matter candidate. Of course, we didn't see any supersymmetry. That's a problem. But still, that's considered if you consider the neutral, it's called a neutralino. Like lino means a fermion. But anyway, so that's a reasonable thing if you're using MSSM, this stands for minimum supersymmetry standard model, then you are very reasonable. But if you are using, you know, even more complicated supersymmetry, or you are using some axion that is unstandard somehow, then you are considered to be weird. And then there is a type of people, they propose there's a dark force. Dark force means it's an entire, like, it's like our force. We have four type of force, or depends on who you ask, like electroweak sometimes counts one, but we have these four type force, and it is described by the gauge theory. But then people could propose there is a dark force, and then this dark force has the dark sector. And then there's dark sector. And then they have a portal to interact to standard model. So if you are proposing this kind of theory, there are two cases. You are cited a lot, then you are just weird. But if nobody cares, then you're just crazy. So at in the end, I want to conclude with a story I heard from Neil Wiener I really like. So he says, so suppose there is a, like it's like in our universe, this 23% of dark matter, 25 or whatever percent of dark matter, they also have a dark university, and there's a Professor Dark. And she's up for tenure. And she says, for them, there was only 4% of missing things. And she says, my proposal is this 4% things is made with bunch of particles respect SU2, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 symmetry, and the symmetry is broken at some point, and there's tons of quarks and gluons, but you can't see them because at some level that they combine together, and there's the electroweak phase transition. Above that, actually, particles are all massless. And then there are three types of neutrino, but somehow they oscillate. And you know, I guess she wouldn't get a tenure. But he is just trying to indicating that maybe the dark sector is not as simple as we thought. So I guess I'll see you in the afternoon for tutorial. And I'll show you one more evidence.